This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org. Also, Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring 100% natural fiber clothing for women and men, real clothing for real people. Proud to sponsor the important voice of KABU. Gazelle is located at Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-288-3422.
When asked why he robbed banks, career criminal Willie Sutton replied, "That's where the money is." We think the same applies to understanding what makes our state tick, so we're going to spend the next half hour looking where the money is in the Oregon economy and where it's going. I'm Dave Mazza, and you're listening to Oregon Notebook, the program that explores the issues that shape our state today. With me this morning is Michael Leachman, policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy, an organization that does in-depth research and analysis on budget, tax, and economic issues. The center's goal is to improve decision-making and generate more opportunities for all Oregonians. Michael is author of OCPP's Biennial State of Working Oregon Report, a resource guide on how Oregon's economy looks from the perspective of low- and middle-income workers. Other research he's done includes corporate taxes, Oregon tax breaks, hunger, and public assistance programs. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here this morning and taking some time out to explain the economy of the state. Not always an easy thing to do. It tends to be reduced to sound bites, as you know, in the mainstream press. So we're looking forward to getting a little meatier representation here. Why don't we start off with a snapshot of the state economy?
Okay, well, you know, we're really still emerging from what was a very long downturn. We started losing jobs in December of 2000, and it took us 4 full years to get back the number of jobs that we had at that point. So the downturn was a very long one. Since then, we've been adding jobs at a pretty quick rate. In 2005, we added about 50,000 jobs. It was about a 3% growth rate. Easily outpaced the growth in the working age population during 2005. So that was it was a good year. The forecast is that job growth will slow in 2006, partly because the construction industry that's been driven by housing growth is expected to slow, and the national economy is expected to slow. Now, even though the economy has been growing again, the benefits of that growth have been going disproportionately to those at the high end of the income scale. And this is similar to what's happened in the last two growth periods in the 80s and 90s. It's not always true. After World War II up into the mid-70s, the growth that we saw, the benefits of that growth were pretty evenly distributed. But in the last generation, the benefits of growth have gone heavily disproportionately to those at the top. And this is what we're seeing again in the growth so far in the growth of the in the current growth period. So, for example, in 2004, as the economy was starting to grow out of that downturn, nearly all the earnings growth that we saw in Oregon went to the highest paid workers. Low pay workers actually lost $93 after adjusting for inflation. Middle pay workers lost $79 on average, and high pay workers gained almost $1,300.
What sort of jobs were we talking about for high paid workers? Who are those people?
Well, there's sort of a mix. Construction, as I mentioned, has been a very rapidly growing industry, and that's actually a relatively high-pay industry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are lots of low-pay jobs in construction, but overall, the industry is a high-pay industry. Manufacturing tends to be relatively high. There are some high-pay jobs in high-tech, although the high-tech industry has been pretty flat. We really lost a lot of jobs in the downturn, and really still hasn't recovered.
And in terms of what segment they represent of the entire workforce, are they the higher end workers? Are they 25% of the entire workforce? Or
I haven't broken it out that way. That's a good question.
Just curious. The other thing, of course, is, the new jobs that have been created during this period, are they predominantly going to the lower end of the scale, the upper end of the scale, or are they evenly distributed?
The evidence that we have so far is that the industries that are growing the most quickly are at the low pay end. And that's partly why we've seen real wages fall at the bottom, is because we've seen rapid growth in those low pay industries. We've also seen population growth that's outpacing the job growth that we've seen. Although that started to turn around in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
Over most of the last couple of years, as the economy has started to emerge from the downturn, the population growth is outpacing the job growth. In addition, because we lost so many jobs and people kept coming here, our population kept growing. We have a buildup of a lot more working age people than jobs available, and so we have a lot of competition for low wage jobs, even though those industries are growing relatively rapidly compared to the. So we're producing mainly low wage jobs, but there's still enough competition for those jobs that wages are held down, and a lot of people are still sitting out on the sidelines,
mm-hmm.
Waiting to. To find a job that's better, that pays a more of a living wage.
It's a deceptive growth. In some ways, we're just treading water in many respects then, since...
That's right. We're still not back where we were before the downturn hit because we lost so many jobs and people have continued to move here.
Mm-hmm. Which, makes us question the mantra we hear so much out of our... out of our leadership and out of our, the corporate sector, which is, the problem is we don't have enough educated workers and we just need people to get more education and train. But what are they training for when they get out?
I think everybody would agree that education in the long term, protecting our education system is a good and, very vital tool for our long term economic development. But I hear your point that as long as the economy is producing low-wage jobs, then there are going to be a lot of workers who aren't going to be earning living wages despite their work effort, regardless of mm-hmm. of their education. Partly what is happening is that people are staying out of the workforce, getting education in hopes that they'll be able to get into one of those higher wage jobs. Excuse me.
Oh, that's okay. I was just going to pop in here for a second and let folks who are just tuning in know that they're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm Dave Mazza. This is Oregon Notebook, and we're talking with Mike Leachman of the Oregon Center for Public Policy about the state of the Oregon economy. And I was going to say, in addition to looking at the job piece of this, what are the sort of the engines of Oregon's economy right now? You know, there was much talk and to-do about the, in the 90s, about bringing high tech in. We signed all these great sweetheart deals with high tech, and most of those companies never really seemed to produce the jobs they promised. So what are the engines driving our economy right now, other than construction, which we've talked a little bit about?
Yeah, you know, in terms of our job base, the job growth really has been in service, and especially in service, in the service industry, also to some extent in retail. So manufacturing, natural resources, which used to really drive Oregon's economy, have slipped as a share of all jobs. And where we've seen growth in our job base most heavily has been in these lower paying, generally, service and retail areas. Now, high tech did really drive our economic growth, although it doesn't produce a lot of jobs. It is an economic engine for the state, although as I mentioned, it was hit hard by the downturn and still hasn't recovered. And the projections are that it's going to stay pretty flat here into the foreseeable future.
Well, hasn't Intel, for example, announced plans to outsource some more jobs? I seem to recall that recently.
Well, they have been doing investment in Asia.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The other thing I'm kind of curious about, and I think our listeners might be curious about, is, you know, you can have an economy that channels a lot of the money back into the state, or you can have an economy that's sort of the colonial model, that the wealth goes elsewhere. And I'm wondering where Oregon falls in terms of being able to hold on to the dollars that we're producing, the wealth we're producing.
Well, you know, I think that's a good question. I don't think that we stand out among states on either end of that scale. You know, what we've really focused on is where the benefits of the growth that we have had are going. So, you know, what's happening, as I mentioned, with incomes across the income scale.
Mm-hmm.
It's clear there that for example, that the top 1% have seen extraordinary income gains over the last generation, a more than doubling of their real incomes after over and above inflation, while median incomes have been pretty flat, and that we've seen a return to that sort of thing as the growth has come back to the economy. So the top 1% saw their real incomes increase by another more than 32,000 in 2003, while the real income of the typical household slipped back, losing another $170. And you can see the effects of this type of growth at on low and middle income families if you look at what's happened in terms of the growth of the payday lending industry in Oregon. Bankruptcies are at record highs. Our hunger rate, while it's improved from a few years ago, is still quite high, and there's some indication that it's increasing again. So, you know, these are the effects of this type of growth, and in the long run, are not good for our state's social fabric, and we think not good for the economy in the long term either.
Yeah, I want to go back to the hunger issue here in just a second, but am I correct in assuming, I think it's one thing that we talk about a lot in progressive circles, is that if you increase the wages of low and middle income workers, they are more apt to be spending their money, those extra dollars, in the local economy, whereas higher up the scale you go, that disposable income oftentimes is channeled into areas where it's actually taking it out of the economy. Is that a correct characterization?
Yeah, it is, and it was an aspect of the recent Bush tax cuts that made them less effective than they could have been as an economic stimulus,
mm-hmm.
because they were disproportionately of benefit to well-off households, and those households are less likely than low and middle-income households to spend the full chunk of the tax cut and push that money back into the economy, create more demand, which, given the type of downturn that we had, would have been exactly what we needed to stimulate the economy, to get things rolling again, and have companies feel comfortable hiring people back, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we think that part of the reason that the downturn was such a long one is that the stimulus package that the administration put together was not as effective as it could have been.
And let me just jump in here again and say, for our folks just tuning in, that you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm Dave Mazza. This is Oregon Notebook. And we're talking this morning with Michael Leachman of the Oregon Center for Public Policy. And we're talking about the state of the economy. Well, let's talk about poverty and hunger. What's the status that we're looking at here in Oregon?
Well, you know, I think as a lot of people know, in the late 90s, actually in 1999, the U.S. Department of Agriculture came out with a study that was the first time that we were able to really get a pretty comprehensive sense of what hunger looked like in America and compared by states. And based on that study, Oregon had one of the highest, if not the highest, hunger rate in the nation. And a string of those national surveys, starting in the mid-90s and running up until just after the turn of the century, showed that we had a high hunger rate over that full period. That was confirmed by state surveys. But since then, we think primarily because the state, working with advocates after the hunger rate was revealed to be so high here, really focused on improving the food stamp program and getting it to more families, to more working Oregonians, that the hunger rate declined here. And so the latest data, which is for the 2002-2004 period, show that Oregon has a middling hunger rate. We're close to the national rate. I mentioned that there's some indication that we may be heading back in the other direction. You know, I'm not sure about that yet, but the state survey that we also use to track hunger shows or suggests that trend may be heading back in the other direction. I'm hopeful that won't happen, but I'm also concerned about it. And the president's budget that was released for 2007 just a couple of days ago includes a food stamp cut that would hit Oregon disproportionately hard. Even though we have less than 2% of the food stamp caseload nationwide, we would get at least 14% of the cuts from that proposal.
And why is that?
Well, because what he wants to eliminate is a provision in the food stamp rules that Oregon Oregon was one of a handful of states that used this provision to increase access to food stamps for working families. That was one of the major tools that we used to improve the program and to lower our hunger rate. So this would take us back in the other direction.
So we're basically being penalized for being successful.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one way to look at it. I mean, it would really take away this key tool that we've used, and it seems crazy that it's had an obvious success, and that you would, that would, you know, take that policy tool away is kind of backwards.
Well, What others are we missing? Any other salient features to the economy? I mean, you know, there's a lot of push for continuing to try to do and more exports. If we can, you know, be part of that great trade system, it's going to pull us out of any problems we have. Is that still proving to be kind of a bust?
Well, you know, I'm not an expert on international trade, but, you know, I know enough about it to know that without labor protections and this sort of thing, that that free trade is a euphemism for just expanding corporate power. And if we're only about expanding corporate power and we're not also concerned about you know, really building an economy that works for everybody, then in the long term that doesn't work for Oregon or for the country or the rest of the world.
Well, we can hardly talk about the economy without touching on taxes. I mean, I think most people feel that our tax structure has gotten pretty warped and is certainly not serving the purpose it was intended. Is that an accurate sense people have, an accurate gut feeling?
Yeah, I mean, the tax structure is a way that we can protect the flow of the benefits of growth. So if the private economy is failing to adequately spread the benefits of growth, as it is, in part because you know, the CEOs and those who protect their salaries have just focused so much of the compensation resources of companies on executive salaries, pushing up CEO salaries to many, many multiples now of the average worker salary. If the private economy is failing in that way, and that's driven, by the way, not by any kind of market demand, you know, that's driven by a culture in amongst executives and the directors of boards.
The magic hand isn't saying we need wealthier CEOs.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that God hasn't decided that, you know, Kenneth Lay and other corporate executives deserve these extraordinarily disproportionate income raises and other compensation increases. When that's happening, it's the public sector's responsibility to protect the long-term economic and social health of the country by using the tools that it has available to have a more equitable system, and that's just a wise investment and long-term thinking that everybody ought to agree with. But we haven't been doing that. As I mentioned, the Bush tax cuts have been disproportionately focused on the high end, so that even as wealthy folks are making out disproportionately from the private economy, they're also making out from the public sector's decisions. And the same thing has happened actually here in Oregon with our state and local taxes. State and local taxes as a share of income for those at the top have been declining, while for those in the middle it's stayed about the same, and for those at the bottom that as a share of their income have actually been increasing.
Which is a far removal from the idea of progressive taxation.
Yes, it's true that the overall system, the federal, state, and local tax system, the overall system is still progressive, but it's not nearly as progressive as it used to be. And given what's happened in the private economy with, you know, so much of the benefits of growth going to those at the top, you know, just decreasing the progressivity of the overall of the federal and state and local system just exacerbates that situation.
Well, in 60 seconds, let's assume that Mike Leachman's made czar of Oregon for the day. What would be your five-point plan for getting our economy going again?
Well, Oregon's economy is driven by the national economy. So if I were czar of Oregon, I would have an important role to play. Much of what happens in our economy is driven by things that are out of my control. Okay. But that said, I would first invest for the long term in our public infrastructure, including our human capital. That means, a strong education system, investing in the basic infrastructure of our roads and our et cetera. But I would also require that the economic development monies that we spend go only to support living wage jobs that provide good health care. First of all, we don't have in any one place compiled how we spend money on economic development, and so I would pull that together into one place so that we can evaluate it effectively, and then I would go through each of those programs and make sure that we were only spending money on living wage jobs.
Okay, well, I'm all ready to get on board the Micah Czar campaign myself, but I want to thank you for coming down here this morning and educating our listeners on the economy. Mike Leachman with the Oregon Center for Progressive Policy. And I want folks to keep in mind that, you know, misery can be kind of an accurate measure of our society. How many children we let go to bed hungry, or how many elderly we let go without medical care. These are what really says a lot about what we value. And we also need to remember that the situation we're currently in isn't some magic marketplace at work. It's the work of deliberate acts of people who want to enrich themselves. So it's up to us to not just stand by idly, or even just become informed and still stand by. We need to become educated. We need to become informed. We need to get out there in the neighborhood, spread the word, and we need to take action. That means voting. That means writing letters. That means taking it to the streets when possible. So you've learned a little about the economy. Now go out there and do something with it. I'm Dave Mazza. Thank you for tuning in to Oregon Notebook.
Everybody, this is the Thursday morning radio zine for February 9th. It is now 9:30. Coming up next, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, it's part 3 of Destruction of the World Trade Center, a lecture by David Ray Griffin, author of The New Pearl Harbor. At 10:30 on Art Focus, Julie Bernard interviews painter Rebecca Guberman-Bloom, currently showing work at the Woolley Gallery. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, more on the controversy over the publication of cartoons depicting the prophet Muhammad. Stay tuned. Press Watch is coming up next.